Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron Corporation and Comcast.
That's theme music from the television series Saint Elsewhere. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. I'm Terry Phillips, and this is a two-hour special about the way we pay for health care here in the Central Valley and in California and in the United States and around the world. We're talking about it all. In the first hour, we focused on the current state of medical care and the way we pay for medical care, the economics of it. And now I'm going to turn to a couple of proposals for improving the way we pay for medical care and by extension, the way we deliver medical care. And I'm pleased to welcome to the Bonner Performing Arts Studio from the emergency room at St. direct from the emergency room at St. Agnes Hospital, Dr. Matt Hendrickson, excuse me, and an internist in private practice here in Fresno, Dr. Steve Chulgen. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And on the telephone with us is Dr. Winthrop Wink Dilloway. He's an MD in New Jersey and representing the physicians for a national health program. Dr. Dilloway, good morning and welcome to Quality of Life. Dr. Dilloway, do I have you on the line? Maybe I don't have you on the line yet. Well, we'll let me just double check to see. Yeah, he's there. Let me just push this button. Dr. Dilloway, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great. We've got you now.
Thank you. Let me
begin by asking you first to talk about why, as a physician, why do you think it's important to have some kind of a national health program?
Well, Terry, thank you for inviting me to the program, and that's the most important question, of course, why to have a national health program. And let me explain that as a member of the Physicians for National Health Program, we advocate for what's called single payer. It's most simply understood as Medicare for all. And I think the bottom line for me and most of us is that it's probably the only way to actually get a national or universal health care. The Medicare for all is seriously misunderstood. Nevertheless, the advantage is that it offers a simplicity, it offers an economy, and it offers a fairness or an equity that no other program comes close to.
Dr. Hendrickson, as an emergency room physician, I'm sure you deal with a fair number of patients who are there not necessarily because it's an emergency or because it had to be an emergency, but because they weren't able to get primary care and maybe waited too long. Am I inferring correctly that this represents some portion of the patients you treat?
We do. About 50% of our patients are either uninsured or underinsured. Underinsured meaning they're spending more than 10% of their total income on health expenses. But that really is a minimal driver of the cost of health care. The primary drivers of health care costs and the reason why the system cannot stop the 45,000 deaths per year, the million bankruptcies per year due to medical causes, and the 1.5 million foreclosures per year due to medical causes, we can't fix that problem unless we address both coverage and cost. Cost cannot be addressed unless you remove the private insurance system, which is 25% tax or surcharge on all interactions, health interactions in our system.
Now, you said removed. Do you think there should be no private insurance?
There is absolutely no value for the private insurance system. Private insurance system basically charges us 20 cents on every transaction that occurs in healthcare to be the insurer. And for that, they actually use that money, they divert that money, a lot of it, towards marketing to the healthy and wealthy and towards avoiding the sick. So we're paying 20 cents on every dollar to a system that is actually acting against the welfare of the country by avoiding the sick and trying to dump them onto a public plan.
Dr. Children, when you see patients, I imagine that somewhere on the list of questions that that your receptionist asks is, how are you going to pay for the doctor's services? What happens if somebody makes an appointment to see you and they don't have insurance and they don't have personal resources to pay for your services? 100 years ago, that wasn't a big issue. It didn't cost that much. But today, that's a significant challenge. So what happens to someone who tries to get care who doesn't have the money? Do they not get care? I mean, is that the
– Well, if they came to my office, they would be seen and be billed directly for their services. But I'm an internist, and there's the size of the charges is not as great as if it was a surgery or a hospitalization. But clearly, people who don't have insurance, you're skating on thin ice, because if you happen to diagnose something that is very serious and requires hospitalization or requires a specialized procedure, you could get into a cost that is well beyond the means of the patient to ever pay for it. So that's why it's so important to have universal access to care. Not universal access to coverage, but to care. They're different. Because you can have health insurance, but if the plan isn't good, you find that you can't afford the high deductibles and you can't afford the cost of services that you thought you could.
And Dr. Dilloway, out there on the East Coast, and by the way, I should specify for our listeners who might not know that Physicians for a National Health Program is a Chicago-based organization that also supports universal health care. I know you've been practicing family medicine for more than 30 years, and would you say that on the East Coast that there's this similarity of patients who not only don't have the personal resources to pay for their own care, but for whom this could eventually lead to bankruptcy and or death because they don't have the money?
Well, absolutely. There's I can't imagine it being different in any significant way in different portions of the country. The bottom line is that, as everybody hears over and over and over again, 47 million people around the country don't have it. And as Dr. Hendrickson, is it?
Yes, sir.
Said that, you know, we have the million bankruptcies, we have the 45,000 deaths. That's across the country, and it really is irrelevant to a particular state or city or portion of the country.
And Dr. Hendrickson, we got a call from a listener who wants to know about the impact of the cost of technology, and particularly on imaging technology. Why does every doctor's office seem to have an MRI rather than having a center where they send patients? I don't know how things are at St. Agnes, for example, but do you think that there is too much technology, and is that a driving cost?
Absolutely.
From your perspective as a physician?
Yeah, there are four driving costs. There are four reasons why the United States is spending twice as much on average per person on healthcare. The first is the administrative costs. We spend twice as much on administrative costs as any other country in the developed world. But the other three are, number one, a fee-for-service system in which physicians are incentivized, unfortunately, to often do more tests and more treatments because of financial reward. The third is that we are spending far more on drugs and technology than other countries because we are not negotiating from a position of size. We're not doing bulk savings, economy of scale savings like a Walmart does, because we've got it divvied up into all these 1,500 different insurance companies. And the fourth is that we practice a defensive medicine because of our highly litigious system.
Dr. Children, I don't want to necessarily assume that you agree with everything that your two colleagues here are saying, but let me ask you about the way that we get to universal care. There are a lot of examples around the world of how other countries are doing this. What's What's the best model to apply here from your perspective? How do we take care of everybody financially?
Yeah. Well, from my perspective, I worked with the Central Valley Health Policy Institute, and we came up with a proposal which we thought would be a practical solution, not the only solution, but a practical solution called CAUSE. And that stood for the Institute of Medicine's five tenets for what makes good comprehensive health care, that it be continuous, no lapses in coverage, affordable to the individual and business, universal care, sustainable for the country, and effective. And a question was asked earlier, why do we need to do this? And the simple reason, I think, is to make our society healthier. That's the reason for health reform. There should be no other reason. If at the end of the day society isn't healthier, then you haven't succeeded. In my view, I do believe we need universal access. I do believe there should be a Medicare for All system that serves as a safety net for society so that everyone has access to that. But I believe it ought to be phased in over 10 to 15 years, because if you suddenly insure 47 million people and don't phase it in, I fear you won't have the health professionals, particularly in underserved areas like Fresno, to take care of the uninsured and underinsured. The reason for the cost of medicine is because most people don't have a medical home. They need a primary care physician, and that primary care physician needs to work with them to deal with five basic conditions: hypertension, diabetes, obesity, smoking, and hyperlipidemia. 3/4 of our money goes to chronic diseases that spring from those five conditions. And so you need a medical home. The way I differ with the two gentlemen who do make a good point in having a single-payer system is I believe there is a role for private insurance. And that role would be to offer supplements for care that is not covered in the basic plan. In fact, the Medicare system utilizes private coverage to pick up 20% of what Medicare doesn't cover.
And even in Great Britain, which is arguably the most socialized medical system in the world, people can still get private medical
right.
care.
Dr. Hendrickson is absolutely right that the private model is not efficient. And the Baucus plan and the Massachusetts model is not going about it the right way, because they're building on the employer-employee connection and having the government subsidize unregulated private insurance rates. So if you can sever that connection and have a different funding source and have a basic plan, you would allow people to choose, but you would still have a safety net so people would have a medical home.
Dr. Dilloway, you undoubtedly know that Harry Reid, the Senate leader, has said that he's now going to be sure there's a public option on the table when the Senate votes on some legislation to reform medical care and the way we pay for it. Is a public option, in your view, a way of improving the way we pay for medical care?
Terry, yes and no. I think the value of what's going on now is that there's no way we can continue with the system as it is. There has to be a reform. And this problem is now been engaged by Congress, and there's serious, thoughtful, intense work on figuring out a way to make a reform. And the public option makes a little bit of sense. It makes a modest movement in a direction that we need to go. Unfortunately, it does not answer the question. It's really not going to work, and we need to be ready to move on to have a universal health care program. The public option number one is not going to be, as Congress is presenting it now, is not going to be very effective and be very available for very many people at a very good time. And it's not going to answer the questions. It's not going to simplify. It's not going to reduce cost, and it's not going to make the system more equitable. The only advantage it has, as far as I'm concerned, is that it engages us in a discussion and helps us go in the direction that finally will be the right thing to do.
Dr. Hendrickson, I know we only have you for a few more minutes, but we got a call from a listener who wants to know about the way about the influence of medication on the way doctors treat their patients. Specifically, the listener says that he or she thinks doctors sometimes prescribe medicines instead of counseling for a better diet, for example, in order to get payments from pharmaceutical companies. And the listener wants to know whether that's true.
Mm. I do think that physicians often do medication triage, where they will shorten a visit by offering a medication, which allows them to see more patients in that hour. But I wanted to return for a moment to this question about whether a private system in some way helps the overall system. In the United Kingdom, the private system is actually eroding the quality of the public system. And this would happen in the United States as well if we maintained a private option. The reason is that the most influential people in our system are the wealthy. If the wealthy have an escape where they can, instead of using the public option, lobbying for the best that the public option can be, the public system, instead, they can avoid it and move to a private system. The quality of that public system will erode. You will have this constant battle between private and public, and the private system will always win as long as those that are most influential in our political system are not in support of it.
Dr. Hendrickson, some reports have indicated that hospitals in the Central Valley, some hospitals might in fact have to close if there were a what some people would call a radical reform to the way we pay for medical care, because they couldn't afford to live by everybody in effect being treated as a Medicare patient. And Dr. Chuljan, I know you've said that it would have to be phased in, but in your view, can hospitals, can medical groups accommodate such a dramatic change?
What's actually happening is that hospitals are already closing because of our current system. The growth of insurance companies, of administrators, has gone up by 3,000% in the last 40 years. 3,000%. The growth of physicians has grown by 200%. The insurance industry is so large and every year consumes a larger and larger percentage of the healthcare budget that leaves less for health care, for actual health care. So removing the private insurance system, which is 20 cents of every dollar spent in this country, removing that allows for all of that money to be devoted to health care, to actually treating patients.
Well, I'm going to let you go so that you can get on your other call, and I've
actually got five more minutes.
Oh, you do? Oh, I'm sorry.
You're
here till 25. Oh, fine. Yeah. Okay. Well, then we'll keep you.
Thanks, Jim.
And Dr. Chuljan, let me ask you about the perspective of making this change over time. So rather than flipping a switch and having everybody on Medicare tomorrow, do you envision this happening over, you said, 15 years?
We looked at it at 15 years. That seems like a long time, but this was our reasoning. First of all, the first phase of the plan, we would cover children, which made sense because the guidelines for treating kids are fairly well established, and you do not get into the ethical questions of as much of you have a 90-year-old person and they have dialysis. Do you cover dialysis or not? Or do you do bypass surgery in a 92-year-old and think that's otherwise healthy? You don't have that with children. And you can also start an educational program in the schools and a real program of prevention that could start them through their whole life towards a healthier way. The other thing we do is we allow patients to buy into a Medicare program for outpatient services. they're not beneficiaries, but they buy into the program that puts money into the Treasury. It deals with the insolvency of Medicare to a certain extent. And by doing that, you get people to – all people to at least have primary preventative care so that they get their colonoscopies and they get their prevention through a medical home. As time passes, more and more of the population are covered. Pilot programs are done to look at effectiveness of different delivery systems for different localities. More physicians and physician assistants and other ancillary care providers are trained. And it just seems to me that that is a sensible way of delivering care. It also makes it more affordable because you are paying for things in phases over time. And a financial way of paying for the first phase would be a financial transactions tax, where there is a 0.5% commission on a stock and bond that goes to a treasury. And you could do that with derivatives and futures and currencies and all kinds of things so that we allow, you know, Wall Street to pay for part of medical care.
Dr. Dilloway, one of the accusations made by critics of medical care reform that we've been hearing, the kind that we've been hearing about, is that it will lead to rationing. Now, I understand that there is some rationing that goes on anyway, but do you see this this risk that medical care would be even further rationed by changing the way we pay for care, by involving, as critics would say, government bureaucrats in the process?
Well, naturally, that's the enormous fear that people have, that the government is really only going to make things worse. Let me respond on two levels about the concept of rationing. Number one, there's no way it could be as poorly rationed as we have it now. It's inconceivable that we could do any worse than we are now. Number two is that every system allocates resources. What I'm doing is shifting the terminology, framing it instead of the word rationing, which has such a negative connotation, into the same exact thing, an allocation of resources. Whether it's a family or a small business or a corporation, every system has to allocate resources to balance in the best way possible income and outflow. So actually, one of the arguments for having a universal health care is that we would have all stakeholders involved, and we absolutely want to allocate the resources in the best way possible. And there's no way we can do it now with the fragmentation of what we have and what Congress is proposing to continue with. So it would allow us a much more management of business as necessary, which should be very attractive even for the most conservative of people.
I want to ask the three of you one last question, and it might be naive, but I'll ask anyway. As physicians, as men who are dedicated to putting your patients' interests ahead of your own, is this the way to make it easier for you to do that, Dr. Hendrickson?
Oh, absolutely. Canadian physicians, on average, have far higher satisfaction with their work than American physicians. American physicians, particularly those that are doing primary care like Dr. Chulgin and emergency medicine like myself, are really seeing the pain and suffering, the brutality of this system and the insanity of it, that we're spending so much money on avoiding taking care of the sick and so little money on the actual care of American citizens.
And apart from the financial concerns, Dr. Chulgin, do you also see this as a way of helping your patients more than you can now?
Absolutely. I definitely believe you need to have everyone covered and have access to care. The one problem I have with the single-payer system is that you get into the sticky argument, and this could be difficult for physicians, is what do you put on the list that's covered,
right,
and what do you leave off? And if you don't have a private alternative to supplement, that's where it really gets difficult.
And Dr. Dilloway, I presume you would agree that this makes it better for you as a physician, not just for the financial interests of your patients and for the country. Yes?
I've had the great privilege of going from a long career in private practice to the last 6 years of being in academic medicine. And I point out to my students that there's really three reasons to go into healthcare to be a physician. One is economics, two is ego, and three is humanism. And I don't care how much economics and ego we have, if we are ethically compromised by the system that we're working in, we're going to be unhappy. And in fact, I have a strong sense about that going on in the healthcare profession right now. There's something seriously amiss in what's happening, and some increasingly unhappy and physicians that are grieving. The system is so out of balance and so unfair. And I don't care how much money we're making, if we can't be contributing humanism and altruism to our patients, then we're not going to be very happy.
Well, we're going to leave it there for this segment. Dr. Dilloway, Dr. Chuljan, and Dr. Hendrickson, I thank the three of you very much for being here this morning. We'll continue with more of Quality of Life and our conversation about the way we pay for healthcare insurance. My producer, Mark Thomas, took his traveling microphone out to find out what you think of health insurance. Here's what some Central Valley residents had to say.
I think it would be good to have healthcare for all the poor people, but I don't think that they should take away from the seniors that are already, struggling.
I don't need any changes for healthcare. I'm covered under a private policy. I don't believe in the reform bill. I know he's trying to pass it as, you can keep your own health care, but if you look at the fine lines, you can keep it as long as you have it. If you change employers or, you want to change your policy, then it cuts it out and you're forced into government ways.
More coverage, more dental. They took away so much dental and eyeglasses and chiropractors and stuff that people need to, have.
I don't really see any need for changes in our health care because we're pretty well covered ourselves.
Ours personally. But we're for health care reform.
I can understand other people wanting better health care.
Make the qualifications a little easier for people that can't afford it.
Just cost overall. I mean, for folks that pay for just normal health insurance, and for the cost of it, better insurance and coverage.
The ability for us to refer ourselves to specialists. Now we have to go through our primary care and they have to refer us.
Security, a sense of security, knowing that my health needs will be taken care of. Basically just to be looked at as a human being who needs help, who needs health care, than as just someone as a commodity or a marketing tool.
I'd rather they fixed Medicare instead of trying to put so much money into all this other stuff, because I don't want more government.
Well, one of the main things is I think the insurance companies, they need to be able to cover more than what they already do, because there's many that they have insurance, but they still have to pay for more than half of it.
I hope that whatever happens, it does not influence my employer to change anything he's doing for me, or the same thing for my wife. And that's probably a very selfish thing when I know there's other people out there that need health care. I hope when it's all said and done that who's ever in charge, and I hope that is us, that we get the right bills passed, that these people do have some kind of health care when it's all said and done.
The oncologist had some interesting things to say. He was advising us to start being our own health advocates even more than ever, because he's afraid that fewer doctors are going to want to become doctors, fewer people are going to want to go into the profession. He's very conservative. We always keep our mouths shut when we talk to him.
I can't say what I really think because it's on a radio station.
You can say what you really think on this radio station. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Again, my thanks to producer Mark Thomas and to production manager Don Weaver for editing that montage of your views on medical care and the way we pay for it.